Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Alice Bryant, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Alexei Verganov is a homeless man living in Omsk, Siberia, in northern Russia. He survives freezing nighttime temperatures of minus 30 degrees Celsius by sleeping under an industrial heating pipe for warmth. It is a dangerous way to live. If he is too far from the pipe, he could die from the cold. If he is too close, he could get severe burns without knowing it. The 46-year-old Verganov has lived like this for more than 11 years. He says, "You sleep at night with your eyes closed, but your ears open." He used to desire for a chance to rebuild his life. But his partner, Alyanka, died of liver cancer 2 years ago. Since then, he has lost the will to change his life. The couple had lived together near the city's train station. Verganov says, "I get through the day, and that's it. If I found a woman like her, I could stop and try to return to society. But I can't find anyone like her." Verganov likes to call himself Yoka the Beard. He is one of 3,500 homeless people officially living in the city of Omsk. But the real number of homeless is likely higher. He is one of the few who stop to talk and laugh with those who live in homes. He likes to joke with them, saying, "It's you that's going to freeze in your apartment with three blankets, not me, between the pipes." His favorite time is night. The city is quiet, and he is free to search through waste areas for glass bottles and other objects. He can then exchange what he finds for a small amount of money at a recycling center. Omsk does have a night shelter for the homeless, but it is in a distant part of town. Verganov does not sleep there. The local homeless people in that area will not let him earn money at the nearby waste area. They see the area as their personal territory. An aid group called Caritas gives out food and clothes to help the city's homeless. But Verganov has also learned to be on the lookout for people who may be a threat. He once saved the life of his friend, Alexander, after a group of teenagers set him on fire. Sometimes, bad experiences and pain can push Omsk's homeless toward trying to return to society. Yusya Stepanova has spent more than 27 years on the streets. The 44-year-old was in the hospital for 3 weeks in January with serious burns across her body. She fell asleep too close to the pipes where she was sheltering. Stepanova is now in a recovery center 30 kilometers away from Omsk. She says, "I plan to go home, to mother. My childhood dreams were noble, but it's too late now. That boat has already sailed."
Wildlife officials at a lake in Kentucky recently used electric shocks and sound to lead huge groups of Asian carp into large nets. This was the latest effort in a 15-year battle to halt the spread of the fish in the United States. The Asian carp is an invasive species that threatens to damage underwater ecosystems. The carp compete for food that native fish eat. They are also blamed for harming endangered mussels and snails along the Mississippi River and other waterways. The Associated Press, or AP, examined data from state and federal agencies about the cost of efforts against Asian carp. The AP found that together they have spent nearly $607 million to stop the fish since 2004. Proposed projects are expected to increase that cost to about $1.5 billion over the next 10 years.
That is more than five times the amount predicted in 2007 when a National Carp Management Plan was created. Programs aim to reduce established populations and prevent further spreading. But wildlife officials admit they may never be able to stop the fish. Much has been done to limit the carp's movement northward and to keep them out of the Great Lakes. Experts say they could severely damage the fishing industry in those bodies of water. The effort includes a proposed underwater electric barrier near Chicago and genetic testing. It also includes payments to commercial fishers and other experiments to harvest the fish. The effort has mostly been successful, yet the lakes remain at risk, and grass carp have been identified in Lake Erie, Lake Ontario, and Lake Michigan. Less money and attention have gone to the carp's nearly unlimited spread east and west into the Missouri and Ohio rivers.
The term Asian carp describes four different species: big head, black, grass, and silver carp. The carp were imported to the U.S. in the 1960s and 1970s as a way to deal with unwanted water plants and parasites. But the fish escaped into many American waterways. Joel Bromier is president of the activist group Alliance for the Great Lakes. He said biologists understood the risks of bringing live, non-native animals into the country. It should have never happened. Greg Conover is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist. He oversaw the development of the National Asian Carp Plan. He saw how many there were in the Mississippi River as he studied native paddlefish in the 1990s. At first, there were no carp. Then we were catching a few carp here and there. Then eventually, we were filling the nets with carp and no paddlefish, he said.
Scientists say that Asian carp in the upper Mississippi River are pushing out valuable native fish such as yellow perch and bluegill. And people who fish for sport say they are seeing the effects. Kevin Irons is with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. He said control efforts have been successful in the parts of the Illinois and Des Plaines rivers. He noted that a combination of methods, including commercial fishing, have removed hundreds of thousands of kilograms of fish from those rivers close to Lake Michigan. to prevent carp from moving northward into Lake Michigan, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is proposing the most costly effort to date. It is an electric barrier near Chicago that also would produce air and noise underwater. Congress is considering the plan, which would cost more than $800 million. At the same time, southern states are increasing efforts to control the fish. Tennessee hired its first aquatic nuisance species coordinator in December. In Kentucky, officials put in place an experimental underwater barrier last November designed to block Asian carp at a lake on the border of Kentucky and Tennessee. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Pete Musto. A new study suggests that a mysterious human species mated with our own species tens of thousands of years ago in Africa. Researchers say the study provides evidence that present-day West Africans can link about 2 to 19% of their genetic ancestry to an extinct human species. The study describes the species as a ghost population. Scientists involved in the research estimated that mating between the two species happened about 43,000 years ago. Homo sapiens, the species of human that exists today, first appeared more than 300,000 years ago in Africa. The species later spread worldwide. Earlier genetic research has shown that our species mated with two early human species, the Neanderthals and the Denisovans. The species have been extinct for thousands of years, but modern human populations outside Africa still carry DNA from both. Scientists have discovered many fossil records relating to the Neanderthals and a few from the Denisovans. So far, though, very little is known about the newly identified ghost population. Sriram Chakaraman is a human genetics and computer science professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. He led the study, which was recently published in Science Advances. Chakaraman told the Reuters news agency that not much is known about this mysterious species. We don't know where this population might have lived, whether it corresponds to known fossils, and what its ultimate fate was, he added. Chakaraman said the extinct species likely split off about 650,000 years ago from the evolutionary line that led to Homo sapiens. The study used genetic data from hundreds of West Africans, including the Yoruba people of Nigeria and Benin and the Mende people of Sierra Leone. The researchers compared the data with DNA information from the Neanderthals and Denisovans. Scientists say they uncovered DNA material in the West Africans
that can best be explained by ancestral interbreeding with an unknown member of the human family tree. Shakaraman said it is no longer necessary to consider only DNA from fossils of early human species to confirm that humans intermixed with them. We can now see that such events took place by looking at our own DNA itself. He added that the discovery opens a new path in understanding the complexity of human evolutionary history in Africa, where the picture hasn't been as clear. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The presidential election of 1928 gave American voters a clear political choice. The Democratic Party nominated Al Smith. He was the popular governor of the state of New York. The Republican Party chose Herbert Hoover. He was an engineer and businessman who served as Secretary of Commerce for Presidents Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge. Rich Kleinfeld and Harry Monroe tell us about the presidential election of 1928.
Governor Alfred Smith of New York had campaigned for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1924. But he was defeated at the party convention by a compromise candidate, John Davis. 4 years later, however, Smith could not be stopped. He had a strong record as governor of the nation's most heavily populated state. He campaigned for the presidency on a policy of building new electric power stations under public control. Smith knew that many conservative Americans might be worried by his new ideas and his belief in strong government. So he chose as his campaign manager a Republican industrial leader who had worked with General Motors, DuPont, and other major companies. Smith hoped this would prove his faith in the American private business system.
Al Smith was a strong political leader and an effective governor, but he frightened many Americans, especially conservative citizens living in rural areas. They lived on farms or in small towns. Al Smith was from the city. And not just from any city, but New York City, a place that seemed big and dirty and filled with foreign people and strange traditions. Al Smith's parents came from Ireland. He grew up in New York and worked as a salesman at the Fulton Fish Market. Smith was an honest man. But many rural Americans simply did not trust people from big cities. Al Smith seemed to them to represent everything that was new, different, and dangerous about American life. But being from New York City was not Al Smith's only problem. He also opposed the new national laws that made it illegal to buy or produce alcoholic drinks. And he had political ties to the New York political machine. But worst of all, in the eyes of many Americans, Al Smith was a Roman Catholic.
From George Washington through Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and up to Calvin Coolidge, every American president had been male, white, and a Protestant Christian. Of course, there was no law requiring a candidate to be Protestant, but millions of traditional Americans just were not ready to give their vote to a Roman Catholic. Opponents of the Smith campaign generally did not speak openly about his religion, but many of them were afraid that Smith would take his orders from the Vatican in Rome, instead of working with the Congress in Washington. Al Smith fought back. He told the country, "I am unable to understand how anything I was taught to believe as a Catholic could possibly be in conflict with what is good citizenship. My faith," he said, "is built upon the laws of God. There can be no conflict between them."
But many Protestant Americans thought there was a conflict, and they looked to the Republican Party to supply a strong candidate to oppose Smith and the Democrats. The Republicans did just that. They nominated former Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover, one of the country's most popular men. Hoover was well known to Americans. People trusted him, and they liked the way he had gained great personal success from poor beginnings. In fact, Hoover's life story would have pleased Abraham Lincoln, another American who rose from a poor family to fame. Hoover was born in the farm state of Iowa in 1874. His father was a poor metal worker who kept moving his family from state to state. Herbert Hoover's father died when the boy was just 6 years old. His mother died 4 years later. Young Herbert had to move to the western state of Oregon to live with his mother's brother. Herbert's uncle was luckier in life than Herbert's parents. He had made money in the land business, and he helped the boy gain admission to Stanford University in California. At the university, Herbert showed great skill in mathematics, and he decided to go into business as a geologist, studying the science of the earth.
After college, Herbert Hoover got a job as a mine worker. During the next several years, Hoover spent most of his time working as an engineer in foreign countries. And he succeeded beyond his greatest dreams. By the time he was 40 years old, he had earned more than $1 million. After World War I, he organized the effort to provide food for starving people in Europe. He did an excellent job, winning praise from people in Europe and the United States alike. Next, Hoover joined the administration of President Warren Harding, serving as the Secretary of Commerce. Again, he did a very good job. Hoover left the cabinet in 1925. But 2 years later, he organized efforts to provide relief for victims of a flood in the southern state of Mississippi. And again, Americans all around the country took note of this quiet, serious man who did such effective work in so many different kinds of situations. Some Americans, however, did not like Hoover, including some people who usually supported Republicans. For example, many professional Republican politicians did not trust him because he had spent most of his life in business, not politics. Some stock market traders thought Hoover might change the rules on the New York Stock Exchange. And many farmers believed Hoover had no new ideas about how to solve their growing economic problems.
This, then, was the choice Americans faced in 1928. On the one hand, Al Smith, a Democrat, a Roman Catholic, a politician from the city, a man wanting some social change. And on the other hand, Herbert Hoover, a Republican, a businessman who had proven the dream that even a poor boy could become great in America, a man who seemed to succeed with every effort he touched. The main issue in the campaign was not economics or religion, but the new national laws banning alcoholic drinks. Hoover was for the laws, Smith against them. The two candidates also argued about how to provide aid to struggling farmers and how to increase electricity and water supplies.
Herbert Hoover won the election of 1928. It was one of the greatest victories in presidential history. Hoover won 58% of the votes. Smith got just 40%. And Hoover captured 444 electoral votes to Smith's 87. And so it was that the engineer and businessman, Herbert Hoover, entered the White House in 1929. There was some trouble the day he moved in. Outgoing President Coolidge was a man who watched every dollar he owned. And he accused some White House workers of stealing his shoes on the day of the inauguration. But finally, safe, conservative, businesslike Herbert Hoover was leading the country.
The nation's stock market reacted by pushing stock prices to record high levels. Everyone expected that economic growth would continue and expand. But the happy times were just a dream. Within 1 year, the stock market collapsed. Millions of people lost their jobs. The nation fell into the worst economic crisis it had ever faced. Herbert Hoover was not personally responsible for the crisis. In many ways, it was his own bad luck to be elected just before the disaster struck. But it was his job to guide the nation through its troubled waters. And he would prove to be the wrong person to give such leadership. His 4 years in office would be one of the most difficult periods in the nation's history.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.